You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
I was enamored as a child consuming animation, and then that developed into me wondering, okay, how is the pie made? You know what I mean? Like, who's behind the curtain? You know what I mean? And that's how I discovered all the black, incredible black animators there are.
Welcome back to the last episode of season 3 of Black Tea. And Mel, what's happening over there? How are you feeling?
I am so tired. This week feels fake. Like, this morning felt fake. We'll get to it later, but like, even the article we were supposed to discuss later, I couldn't find it. Like, I'm just really tired. This doesn't even feel real right now, Dalton. Like, is this beautiful mind? Like, are we really recording it?
Perhaps it's post Kanye West drink champs symptoms,
right,
you know?
Right. Okay, so Kanye did that drink champs, and like, every time I get really depressed and I need something to do, there's always something to do on YouTube. I find YouTube to be probably number 3 after therapy and like just other mental health resources. I'm always on YouTube if I'm not feeling well. So Kanye did that. I think it dropped on Saturday night, but I was like browsing YouTube, watching like Hollywood Unlocked or something. And I watched it in full. So I guess we'll just talk about it. Did you listen to Kanye's Drink Champs interview? And Drink Champs is a podcast hosted by Noriega and another guy whose name I don't know.
That is correct. Yeah, no, I did check it out. And I had to check it out. I mean, it's Kanye West, you know, or sorry, Ye, because he's going through a name change. Ye, you know, basically demonstrated to us that he marches to the beat of his own drummer. That's for sure. He had some, he's for me, kind of like that, you know, textbook, idiot savant. I mean, he said some things in there. Yeah, there's a lot of wildly interesting.
When you have $1 billion and we don't know if you're taking care of yourself, this is what he does. He goes on streams of consciousness. Some make sense, some don't. But if he wasn't a billionaire, we wouldn't think he's smart. We'd just be like, what is this guy talking about? Like, for example, when he was saying that Soulja Boy's verse wasn't good on Donda, he didn't elaborate because he just wanted to get the soundbite out there. But then when he was critiquing Saturday Night Live and saying that, like, Kim talked about the divorce, which the most offensive thing she did was disrespect Nicole Brown Simpson and joke about OJ. But those Kanye jokes weren't really good. I really don't think they were good. I don't really love a woman saying, I married the richest black man in America, like a white woman. It wasn't like everybody loved that. But Kanye basically blamed SNL and said he hasn't seen the divorce papers. But I wrote an article in February that said that they both got the divorce going and they signed. So he's not even telling the truth, but we all just think like, oh my God, Kanye's so smart because he said he didn't sign his divorce papers. Like, they're signed, Kanye. TMZ published them.
Right.
Like, I mean, my whole thing is like, at least make it the truth. How is he a genius?
Yeah, I mean, he's talking about some concepts that I think...
Well, look what he did to Big Sean. He said, my biggest mistake was signing him.
On my tombstone, it's going to say, I deserve to be here because I signed Big Sean.
And they were just hanging out, and Big Sean tweeted a picture of it. And it's just like, oh my God, you're such a genius, Kanye. So now Big Sean's going to go on Drink Champs. So it's just like, again, am I supposed to be celebrating this?
Yeah. Yeah. Any Kanye interview is worth celebrating. I think there's some concepts in there that, some aspects of our community might not get now, tied to ownership. And there's just things in there that, again, it's going to go over the head of the vast majority, you know, but it's fine.
Of course, he likes to sneak in those gems on the bookends of these wild statements so we don't talk about them. But yeah, he was talking about ownership when he started doing fashion. That's why he owns everything.
Yeah,
wouldn't it be nice if Kanye sat down and did an interview about that so we could hear him clearly? Because that's not my fault that I didn't hear him. Like, I want to talk about Big Sean because that was the soundbite. That's Kanye's fault.
Yeah, and it's supposed to be. I think he wants to be, you know, intentionally messy and, and say a bunch of things that are just provocative and, really smart.
Well, I'm offended. It's beyond provocative when you say it was a mistake to sign the man. And basically what it looks like, and Big Sean probably didn't want to go public with it, but it looks like some record deal and apparently he's lost millions. And Kanye was like, oh, I was there with your family. I was there with your mom. It's like, yeah, if people are getting it from the dirt and you sign them, yeah, you're going to know their family. But if you really like embezzled $3 million from him as Kanye West, and now you're saying he was the mistake, like, bruh, you're the mistake. Like, Kanye, let's do better. I think he's like, what, isn't he 40 now? Like, let's do better at 40.
And I think once he donned that, the red hat. I think he lost a lot of credibility in the community. But yeah, but I take, again, equal parts. I sort of, I don't, you know, for Kanye is not black and white for me. Neither is, you know, Big Sean nor John Legend. There are some parts of John Legend I think are a joke. And others, yeah.
Well, that's what he said. Big Sean and John Legend, they went with the Democrats and threw me under the bus. But I don't like John Legend's music. I think it's boring. And anybody that could love Chrissy Teigen that much, like, there's something wrong with them. And Big Sean, I love his music. I don't like his albums, but I like his collabs. But if he, if Kanye didn't pay him, he deserves to get paid because he's doing a job. So that's my whole thing about Sean. I don't have to love Sean as a rapper to think that he should be compensated for his work. And like, why are we talking about this? Because Kanye said it. So again, I just think that he could use some good PR. I know he was saying that he doesn't like Kim's publicist, but I think it's Tracy Romolos, who used to be his publicist. So you need a publicist again, Kanye.
Yeah, for sure. And Kanye is not, you know, unlike many public figures, both in and outside of our community, he can't be controlled.
He's just a man that doesn't know how to stop talking.
Well, I mean, I think beyond that, I mean, and, you know, back to the music, I mean, you know, so his music is, you know, it's really good. He's a good musician, good producer, a good
rapper.
He's
amazing. And Don does a great album. It reminds me of The Life of Pablo. So shout out to Kanye for being really confusing and trying to control what we consume. Like, I'd love it if he could just shoes, album, whatever he's doing in terms of like architecture and art. And then that's it. Like, I just feel like when we get caught up in this, that's Kanye's fault. Because he's controlling the news cycle around himself.
That's right. And it's perfectly okay and understandable to both love and hate Kanye. You know, as human beings, we are complex, contradictory, you know, humans, right? So I'm okay with that.
Well, he said in I Love Kanye, he wants that. He wants us to, you know, debate it. So yeah, Kanye is a complex dude, and he enjoys when we unpack him. So good for him.
That's right. Hooray, Kanye. I mean, yay.
Exactly.
That's enough yay for today. Anyways, we're going to get into this fantastic interview we conducted with G. Garima. And he's an animator based out of Toronto, Canada. And this young man has done so much fantastic work. He's worked with Marvel Comics. He provided the animation and some of the creative inspiration behind a new series that's coming out on CBC Gem called Big Blue. And so tune in.
So as more Canadians increasingly join the fight against climate change, and with COP26 drawing worldwide attention to the climate crisis, one new kids series created by Toronto-based Ghanaian-Canadian animator, who we have today, Jima Gariba, will help children and their families understand climate change and teach them about the importance of taking care of our planet and each other. Grammy Award-winning producer Timberland and his Beat Club team produced a series theme song titled Big Blue. The animated sci-fi comedy will make its world premiere on CBC and CBC Gem. Created by Jima Gariba, named one of 15 young and African creatives rebranding Africa by Forbes, who has designed covers for Marvel Comics and also has a massive online following for his distinct illustrative style. Big Blue is an imaginative series that follows sibling underwater adventures Letty and Limo, inspired by Gima's own siblings, who lead a quirky submarine crew with a magical ocean fairy stowaway named Beacon Barry. Jima's Breaking Barriers is one of the few Black children's animators in Canada. Not to mention, he's also redefining what the next generation of climate change activists look like. So welcome to the show, Jima. How you doing?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
One of the first things I wanted to ask you is about actually an article I read that Huda Hassan wrote in CBC Arts in July. And it's entitled How Jima Gariba is Using Caricature to Push for a More Empathetic World. And it's an incredibly dense article about like an anti-gay bill in Ghana, your art. It's just a great interview. I was wondering if you could sort of talk about that process and this article.
I mean, talking to Huda is great. It was a really great interview. She's like one of the best people ever, writes really great stuff. I think the basis of the interview was really just talking about this anti-LGBTQ bill that's been kind of presented in Ghana over the last couple of years. I am Ghanaian. I was born and raised there. So this is the connection to this bill. And I'm also a queer person. I think the article is really just about what everyone can do to kind of raise awareness about how archaic and damaging those laws can be, especially in places like Ghana, where the LGBTQ community don't have any kind of protections against violence. Just kind of amplifying it as much as possible, like on the world stage, to just say that like these little things are like the tiny pieces of legislation that if they get ignored become part of like society and more difficult to entangle with time. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's like kind of like, excuse my French, like calling bullshit on some of the things that people try to pass underneath your nose as you're just moving through like this difficult time and in this like kind of transformative last couple of years we've had. Just campaigning for a better future.
Well, one of the things that I love, about this article is that the way Huda frames it, and she says she spoke with you about your two recent pieces, using illustrations to provoke conversations about sexuality in Africa, how we can collectively transform our empathy into direct action. And we're going to link this article so you guys can read it too, the listeners can read it. And it's just these beautiful pieces that you drew. I was just wondering if you could talk about them.
Yeah, thank you. I was lucky enough, like from a really young age, to like understand what I wanted my calling to be and what I felt drawn to as like a person, which is like visual arts and like just the medium of like visual representation of storytelling. And I feel like in a lot of my work, like in the different mediums that I use, I really like to kind of use it to be transportive, in the sense that with all of this LGBTQ activism and things like that, like I think what the media tries to do is to sexualize it or to vilify it.
I mean, it has to be something. It has to be provoke something. It just can't be.
It just can't be. So I think a lot of the imagery that's created around it is like highlighting parts of it that I don't necessarily have a connection to. Like when I think about my queerness and I think about love, I think about things that are soft, tender, ethereal, like extremely delicate, you know what I mean? So I feel like creating work that is like overtly queer and that kind of embodies the gentler side of what it looks like can open the conversation in a different way surrounding like representation and people seeing themselves as Africans and as queer, you know?
You just talked about this idea of representation. Now, you know, I'm a father of two children and my kids grew up intentionally watching shows like Dora the Explorer, you know,
right.
Hip Hop Harry. And these are shows that, you know, that was intentional on my part because, you know, my kids are both Black. And then, you know, this idea of having them watch, you know, mostly all white characters was a bit problematic in my opinion. So can you sort of expand on this idea, you know, this idea around having a diverse animated cast attached to this show? Because that's just glaring and obvious and amazing.
I think like a lot of, like what you're mentioning, like having your kids consume content that only features children that don't necessarily look like them is something that personally I had to deal with growing up, is just like having to project myself into fantasy worlds where I just didn't see myself in them. You know what I mean? Like if I was a fan of Lord of the Rings, I would have to imagine the character that looked like me in order for me to be a part of that world, mm-hmm, you know?
Totally.
So with this show, like I thought it was such an amazing opportunity to finally like present a property where the seat for the Black kids is reserved instead of them having to build their own, you know what I mean? Where it's like, yeah, you can sit right here. Like your spot.
You belong
here. You know what I mean? Especially, especially it being a sci-fi show. I thought that was a very specific thing that I wanted also, is that like, yeah, like I want to see them like use their futuristic shell phones underwater and like use like all these futuristic like devices and things like that, because that's always something that I had to do for myself. Like, the first few Star Wars that came out, you're like, oh, it would be so cool, like, to have more, you know, more Samuel L. Jacksons, you know?
Right,
like,
we didn't know.
Cool, I mean, you know what I mean?
I think it would be good on Earth if we had a bunch of Samuels just running around. Yeah. But you're absolutely right for one show, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, like with any show that I remember watching as a kid, I would always like Dragon Ball or like Pokemon, like, you get characters that you can kind of project yourself onto, like Brock. Like, I'm not even sure where Brock is from. But, like, to really see yourself represented is just, like, something that I thought would would be nice. It'd be fun. And the potential for dreaming is like amplified tenfold. You're like, oh, I don't have to think about the part where I'm in the show. I'm already in the show and I can just think right. about everything else that I like about it, you know?
That's so interesting because I was about to say dream, right? Like it's these things that we can actually dream. Like our dreams can come true. We have the ability to dream. To me, that's what real freedom is. So not to be super emo and deep about Big Blue, because I watched an episode as well.
It's pretty silly.
I thought it was, but it's great because it explains, you know, climate change, something that I'm familiar with, but it is scary even as an adult. And I like the fact that kids are interested in it because we have to create a better world. So how do you feel about sort of that intersection using your art for that message in the show?
I think just with the medium of animation, it's a really great way to kind of just like put forward like metaphors about like bigger concepts. So in terms of like the themes of the show, like empathy for your environment is a really heady concept. But what if Mother Nature wasn't so much of like a matriarch or something that's like looming? And what if it was just your little sister, your goofy little sister? And especially with the medium of animation, you can take a concept and then embody it in a character just to have a one-to-one, like a good versus evil story all of a sudden has so much more nuance. Like your best friend being a dolphin all of a sudden is about a relationship with animals. But yeah, it's just about trying to tell like really true stories with as many like goofy elements as possible so it doesn't feel too... like too much. So it doesn't feel like too much, you know, like just having fun talking about important things.
Yeah. And the interesting thing with your, you know, with the show, you know, Big Blue, it, you know, it is very timely and topical. And the reason I say that is, I mean, you would have been sleeping under a rock to not notice that, you know, even this weekend, you know, all eyes have been on Scotland, right? It's like it was the first week of the UN climate conference, right? Known as COP26. Mm-hmm. And you know, they said the conference was apparently delayed by a year because of the pandemic. But, you know, this is a massive international undertaking that has seen countries recommit to tackling the climate crisis and rising global temperatures. And it was interesting. Yeah. I was watching the protests in Toronto, you know, where we're based. And so I'm watching the climate change weekend protests, and I honestly saw like very few Black people out there. I got to be honest. And you know, if you scan the crowds, and I'm just wondering. I mean, I scan every crowd looking for Black people, but that's just me.
they're razor focused a little.
I'm always looking for Black men. Yeah. Women, but usually men. Anyway,
do you want to expand on that, Mel? Black men, come on. Are we single?
Yeah, but you're talking about I'm looking into a crowd. Like if I'm looking into a crowd, I'm looking for a man. Like, no offense.
Totally. Now, Jima, now it's not like, you know, you're not a climate activist per se, but rather like all Canadians, you're doing your part to fight against climate change, you know, vis-a-vis the show. But do you think, you know, climate change activisms and issues, are they a priority in our community? You know, whether it be in Ghana, where you grew up, in Toronto, where you are now, like, what do you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not an expert by any stretch, but I do really, really think that part of what is holding us back is like not being able to see that most of these things are like extremely interconnected. So like, it's not so much specifically about climate change, but it's more about like my relationship with my community and my relationship with the world I live in. Like it's more one-to-one, you know what I mean? Like I always think of it from the perspective of like just me as an individual. And I know that growing up in Ghana, the only thing that was holding me and my friends back from feeling like we lived in a utopia was, well, one of many, homophobia. And then further, the pollution, the littering in the oceans. Like we'd be going boogie boarding and then there would be plastic bags like slapping us in the face. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And when I think back on my life and I think about being a child, like I could never understand why us as Ghanaians place so much value on like going to like Ibiza or whatever, but couldn't cultivate that same relationship with the environment that was immediately around us. And I think that happens all over the world. You know what I mean? Like,
that's so interesting.
Yeah. And I think that was my entryway into it, being like, I think if everybody just thinks about it in that way, like you could have your utopia and your immediate community could like thrive so much from it. Like,
what you made me think of was Indigenous people. Like they could actually be teaching us how to be at one with the land. Like that's what I started thinking when like making those connections to home and land, even food.
Totally. All those things are interconnected. And even just like you said before, like, not to be like a conspiracy theorist and things like that, but it's like a climate crisis conversation being delayed because of a global pandemic feels like there's a larger health and wellness issue in the world.
Feels like that, passing the buck.
And that it feels like the common denominator is the lack of care in communities, or like the lack of visibility, or like the lack of listening to these communities or something. I'm just trying to figure out the common denominator between all of these things and like find the best thing to connect them back together, you know?
I think you hit it spot on.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And we have to make those connections and apply it to our day to day, you know? Like I always talk, just like education, like you can do, you know, go to university, college, do graduate work, whatever. But it, you know, I think with students, you know, they're struggling. If you can't connect it to your day to day, it's just like, it's going to feel like a chore, you know, reading about climate change is going to feel like an absolute chore.
Totally.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. Like I think about it all the time in terms of like talking to my nieces and nephews, like, if you can't explain it to my niece who's 6 now, or my nephew who's like 3, do you really know it? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, to be able to have the conversation with them, you know what I mean? In a way that's not super daunting, or like not hidden behind academic or like unburdened by academic jargon, to make it not feel like it's like you have to graduate from Harvard in order to do anything helpful. I think that's nonsense.
I hear you.
Yeah. I think you can start the conversation really early and really casually.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, even speaking of that, like, you know, our show serves as a bit of a platform around Black excellence. And, you know, you're a young-ish guy. And like, your career started before you graduated from Sheridan College, when you joined the character design team for Black Dynamite. Like that... Black Dynamite is off the charts. So can you talk to us even just about being an accomplished young animator who's designed covers for Marvel Comics, you know, which I grew up like, I'm a comic book junkie, and all of these great accolades. Forbes magazine, they named you one of 15 young African creatives rebranding Africa a couple years ago. When you wanted to become an animator, can you sort of walk us through some of your early inspirations? Because I suspect that there aren't a lot of major Black animators that we're just seeing out there, like in Canada, for example. Like if you were to ask me, do I know any, accomplished, celebrated Black animators in Toronto or Canada in general, I'm drawing blanks, you know? So can you sort of talk to us how you even got involved in animation?
Yeah, I think earlier on it started from kind of the infinite potential. Like me getting into animation was just about loving to draw, losing myself in drawing, and then later on realizing like the potential of what it was, like the potential of creating a brand new world on paper. Like I was talking to you about a little bit earlier, like when you can't see yourself in a lot of things, you start to like build the seat for yourself. And I think honing the skill of drawing and getting the things that were in my head better and better represented on a page was a very liberating feeling for me. And I think getting into animation was just like continuing that conversation. It's like, okay, I can get a still image to look exactly how I want it to look and feel. Can I make 2 minutes of a film feel like I want it to feel? And I think the natural progression into that was animation, just because it's a medium where you can kind of be a control freak. You can be a master of your own little universe and tell a very specific story. And I thought that potential was like super limitless. And in terms of the Black animation scene, I just nerded out about animation. And one of the beautiful things about animation is that like, if you do it correctly, it doesn't really matter who made it. You know what I mean? It feels like they're real characters at a certain point, or that's the goal, at least. You know what I mean? So there are so many amazing Black animators, but the only reasons I know about them is because I'm really interested in the medium of animation. Mm-hmm. I was enamored as a child consuming animation, and then that developed into me wondering, okay, how is the pie made? You know what I mean? Like, who's behind the curtain? You know what I mean? And that's how I discovered all the Black, incredible Black animators there are. So my obsession has really just driven all of my knowledge about the medium, but there are countless amazing Black animators. In Toronto alone, there's an animator named Shaz Lim, who does incredible shorts. Freddy Carrasco is an incredible animator. He made a comic book called Gleam that just won a bunch of awards. He's actually the inspiration for one of the characters, the turtle Freddy in the show, because we came up together working in animation and things. And Shaz animated one of the dances from the intro. Yeah, whenever possible, like, we try to, like, uplift each other and work together and, like, just find ways for us all to rise at the same time, because it's the nature of the medium for you to be kind of behind, be behind a veil. Like, it's by design that animators and Black, some of the most iconic Black artists are hidden behind the veil of animation. I think even for Little Mermaid, one of the most iconic scenes in Little Mermaid was animated by, like, a Black man. Or, like,
I was about to say, are you talking about Sebastian? Sebastian being Jamaican or something different?
No, something totally different. Like, the draftsman, like, one of the people who drew her, like, closer to her final design was, like, a Black animator. And he's done, like, countless amazing things. So, yeah, I think we're out there. It just takes a little bit of digging. And I've had a lot of great mentors that have been... yeah, uplifting, encouraging every step of the way. Yeah.
During this interview, you're talking to us about, you're referencing sort of community, a community of animators, you know, that might happen to be racialized. You're referencing your family. A couple of the main characters in Big Blue are actually inspired by your own siblings. Is that correct?
Yeah, for sure. The initial nugget of the idea was really based on my family. So I do have an older sister named Letty. I have an older brother named Lemo. And Baconberry was a word my youngest sibling used to say all the time. And we've always just been in awe of their, like, intelligence and tenacity. Like, we always joke about them being, like, the best of all of us. And I thought bringing that metaphor into this show that's about family was really fun, and have it be more about, like, the family of the crew. Because I always thought that, like, a relationship among kids or among siblings is one that doesn't have the kind of, like, foreboding eye of, like, an adult that everybody has to behave for. So the kids actually are able to be more themselves and have fun and make mistakes in a way that they wouldn't be able to make mistakes if they were under the watchful eye of, like, a teacher or, like, a parent. So the show was a really fun way to, like, tap back into, like, just being young and being with, like, my brother and sister, and, like, them having to come to the conclusion as little kids to be like, oh my God, I don't want to share this cookie, but I think I love you. I think I love you. You know what I mean? Like,
that's
just the like kid, that kid, like, dilemma. It's so honest and so pure that it's like, you're like fighting for 5 hours, or like my niece and nephew will be fighting for like 2 hours. And then by the end of it, without you intervening, they'll be like, I'm sorry. Okay. I just need a nap. And you're like, yo, that's so real. That's very real. You know? So tapping into that with the show really felt, like, natural. And to be honest, those are all the skills I use in my adult life. It's, like, everything I learned, like, just, like, with my friends as a kid. Like, what felt like a good thing to do? What felt like a bad thing to do? What was a funny day? You know what I mean? So it's been a really fun ride to kind of jump back into those concepts during the making of the show.
Nice, nice, yeah. So, I mean, Jima Gariba, I want to thank you for coming on the show, man. Like, this, you know, Big Blue, it's this great animated sci-fi comedy series. It's making its world premiere in Canada on CBC Kids and CBC Gem, beginning Saturday, December 4th. You heard that? Saturday, December the 4th onwards. So you all of our listeners, go tune in, support Jima's work, support Big Blue. It's just an amazing series. Thank you.
Thanks, Jima.
Thank you guys so much. This has been an honor.
So welcome back to our very last tea segment in our third season. The Toronto Star published a piece critiquing activist Desmond Cole, which I found really interesting considering how much Desmond's done for the paper and the way he was the way he left the paper. But, you know, these people, they just have no shame. And the article was written by Royce and James. Again, not my favorite writer in the world. But apparently, I'm not his either because he critiqued my article. And whenever people write about my writing, I'm like, oh my God, I feel so special. Because it was from 3 years ago. So I'm like, I just feel like Royson's like at home reading my writing in bed. So shout out to you, Royson. But Dalton, did you get to read the article?
Yeah. I checked it out. I met Royson when I was an editor at this magazine called Word Magazine many years ago. And so he's like an OG.
He's like a mentor in these streets. Well, so I thought.
Yeah, no, he is. Yeah, a lot of people sort of came up under Royson James.
I didn't. I wish I could have done that, but I didn't. So the article, let's do the title and then let's talk to the serious points of it because there's a lot of serious points of the article. So it is called The Divisive Activism of Desmond Cole, colon, for dramatic pause, how a campaign against a black judge, black is capitalized, thanks Star, shattered Toronto's black community. So 18-minute read, he's not lying, it's 18 minutes, but I think we got to go with 2 points. And the 2 points I wanted to talk about was when Royson talked about, this is all about community and interfighting, and that's why white people are like, yeah, like they love to see us arguing, but I actually think this is what community means, despite what Royson's saying. So I want to talk about when he was talking about love, when he was trying to call Desmond in or out, and then I want to talk about what he says about Donald McLeod, because I think that's a big meaty part of the argument, okay?
Absolutely.
Okay, so the first quote about love, you can love Cole in the Christian sense of loving your brother or your enemy, even though we're not all Christians, and I'm not, so I'm like, what? But I'm going to continue. Like, though, is a term of endearment. To a growing number of African Canadians, Cole is anything but likable. I didn't know we had to be likable. Sorry, this isn't like 1950. Mainstream media treat Cole as a go-to talking head on racism. Again, hater. Progressive white folks by the thousands, I agree, follow him on Twitter, and allies of black causes embrace this award-winning author, thank you, and social media influencer. He's not an influencer. People who are influencers, that's their job. Desmond does not sell products. But at a number of dinner tables where curried goat or roti, Trump steak and potatoes, I'm so hungry now because I do both, in many barbershops, don't know because I'm not a man, but thanks. Healing circles and prayer groups, again, we're not all religious. Cole is a daily chewed up and spat out. So you guys have, I mean, when I say you guys, I mean the community he's talking about because I'm in the community too, like despite what he's saying. And like this whole like barbershop, hetero, patriarchal thing he's talking about is true. I am shut out of it, but you guys have been using him as a chew toy. And I want, when I say you guys, I'm not talking to you, Dalton. I'm not talking to every single black man in this city, but I'm talking to black Canadians in general who don't like Desmond. If you don't like somebody, that's fine. But like that's, not liking somebody is not a reason to not like their work. So I think there's a lot of conflating there. But Cole has been a chew toy, so I'm glad that Royson admitted that. And Desmond actually tweeted, I think this may be his only response to the article, and I wanted to make this connection because he tweeted on November 9th, which I guess was a couple days after the article came out. I don't know if we mentioned when it came out. It was last Sunday. He goes, when that writer spoke of love in his attack piece, he told on himself, love me when I put myself at risk for black folks, but hates criticisms of the, oh, I might God, I just said that, of the heteropatriarchal seat at the table black leadership that leaves so many of us behind. That's not love, fam. You can keep it. So again, I agree. And as somebody who Royson has not mentored or brought up or helped and who just happens to be a part of the community, like I deeply apologize if you don't think because I'm not eating roti with you and getting my hair cut, I'm not a part of it. I am. That's why you quoted me in the article, Royson. And he critiqued me and basically said this article I wrote in Maclean's with Lincoln Anthony Blades 3 years ago. He said we sounded arrogant when he quoted us. I won't read the quote because it's super long. And if you think that's arrogant, that's totally fine because I'm not sitting here reading your writing from 3 years ago. But what do you think, Dalton? What do you think about conflating love like that?
Right. I mean, again, Royson is a very, you know, very well respected in the black community, in some segments of the black community. And we are a heterogeneous community, just like any other community. Yep. So for me, I fully expect a wide range of hot takes on what advancement really means. And I think there's always going to be a generational divide and rift. And I think with social,
you think it's generation?
Yeah, I mean, I think generation, that what I would say is, I think is, you know, I see sort of like Generation X, like Generation Z and millennial activists, there's some parts of what you know, I feel like there's some distrust of the
like people that
school.
Call themselves activists, because Desmond doesn't call himself an activist. Other people do that. That's just a projection. Or do you just mean people that care about stuff? Like, I don't consider myself an activist, but like Royson probably would.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I think, I think there is a bit of distrust on both sides. The same goes in reverse. Just to give you an example, it's a bit of it's like social media. Let's look at social media. So a lot of the activists of, Generation X, baby boomers, there was no real kind of like social media circus kind of thing. So it's kind of like social media has created a bit of this invisible wall where much of the talking is being done behind keyboards. Whereas
that's how people are getting their work done, but that's how people are sharing their work. So like that's you're saying that like he could argue that Jasmine could be a keyboard warrior, even though he wrote a best-selling book. And has 80,000 followers on Twitter. No, I'm just saying
that
people.
No,
like,
that's not me. No, I don't think that.
No. But I'm just saying that when people talk about millennials and tweeting and all that kind of stuff, like that's me what they're talking about. But then you'll see the women of The View be like, "Oh, I don't like Twitter and all these high profile people on all these shows that I want to be on talking bad about Twitter." Then you go on their Twitter, they have 100,000 followers, they have a million followers, and they need them. So it's just like, what are we really talking about here? I just feel like this whole language of protest, it is happening on social media for a lot of young people that have to be at their computers, that sometimes live in countries where you can't go to the streets. So I just feel like if we're going to critique social media, like let's all participate in it and realize that there are bad, there's Facebook, which is like an evil empire, but there's also Twitter where people are sharing news.
Right. Okay. My critique of social media, I mean, I'm super active on social media and love social media, but I think it has created this invisible wall where too much of the talking is being done behind keyboards, whereas it might be a good idea to sit in a room face to face and hammer out something that looks like an agenda for the advancement of Black people in this country. And so sometimes, when I'm on Twitter, I see people going at it. I'm just like, yeah, have these two ever actually sat down at, or on the phone or on Zoom? And the answer is no. No, they haven't. So many of these people, they haven't even spoken to one another, right? They're speaking. So which is sad to me, but anyways.
Well, that's the thing. It's so interesting you say that, because when I used to work in the community and I actually used to go to these meetings and meet people face to face, we'd still go at it online a week later. But I absolutely think we do need to do both. But yeah, this isn't 1990. Like we're able to talk to each other more. Like we used to have to wait as a community, even when I was working in it, and I'm still relatively new, 2-3 weeks to have a meeting, a month to meet with the government. Like, yeah, now we talk.
So talking to one another, I think across generations, I think that's it's a healthy approach. And the social media, my critique is, or I can reference, there's one of my favorite books. It's by Ralph Ellison. It's called Invisible Man. And there's a section in it called The Battle Royal. And it's a scene. It's an interesting scene. The narrator basically arrives and receives instructions to take part in this battle royal. And what ends up happening, just in the 2-second version, is that these two Black men are beating each other to a pulp, much to the enjoyment of their white male observers. So there's a lot of this kind of, battle royal kind of feeling, when it comes to
in
looking
this?
At the Toronto Black activism.
That's what they're doing on Twitter. That's so great.
No, that's what it feels like to me. So wow. Like I said, I would be great for, people to kind of just actually talk to one another and just kind of, that would be awesome.
Yeah, I mean, as a community, I'm not concerned about that. Like, I don't read things like this and think these guys don't talk. Like, but because I'm a part of the community, I just feel like we kind of. But maybe I think the community exists that doesn't. Like, I just thought that we're allowed to, voice our opinion and be different. But for me, being different and having a diversity of thought and talking through them, that's like top five for me in terms of community. It's important
awesome.
To me. And the way Royson frames it is a negative. So I think that's why I don't agree with so many things in the piece. But I really want to get to the Donald McLeod piece because I think it's important. I don't want us to run out of time. So why don't you read the Donald quote?
Okay. So the collateral damage runs wide and deep. It has had an impact in quelling the volunteer participation of some people who are just not prepared for the attacks, says Craig Wellington, executive director of a new community organization called the Black Opportunity Fund. Call it the Cole chill? Cole's more vocal detractors, there are many, surprisingly so, considering his high-profile, commendable confrontation of Toronto police carding practices, say they arrived at their negative conclusions about Cole slowly and painfully over years. Many others landed there in a burst of outrage last year. That's when a judicial panel hearing called to determine whether a Black judge, Donald McLeod, compromised judicial standards by improperly advocating for Black people, revealed that the most serious complainant against McLeod, an allegation of perjury, arose from Cole's own February 2019 blog.
Okay. And I think that is extremely important for people. So people that want to read this article, Royston focuses on it. And I really like the fact that somebody sat there and took the time to do this, because as a community, we've all been talking about Donald, but somebody needed to write it out. So I appreciated that. So Dalton, we've talked about this a lot. What do you think? Oh, by the way, Donald McLeod is an Ontario judge. He's Black. And I think he's been sitting at the bench for probably like 10 years, maybe.
So Donald McLeod, yeah, no, he's upstanding, you know, member of the community. And I think there were parts of the community that that felt like, you know, that he was being, you know, that, you know, his role with the Federation, there was, you know, which is, mm-hmm. these were the charges that were, you know, sort of, you know,
and this is
at
the
him.
Federation of, what was it called? The Federation of Black Canadians. This was the whole critique. So I guess Donald had a leadership role there, and that was the critique. So just to put that quote in context, that very important quote. So essentially, I think one of the biggest problems, because this did create a lot of discord in the community, were people thinking that Desmond being such an active figurehead in the community and Donald being so prominent, and Donald's done so much for the community for so many years. I actually worked for him when I was in law school in first year and second year. He was an amazing lawyer. I think he was trained by Johnny Cochran. Like, Donald was just excellent. And it was such a great experience working for him. So he's well-respected for sure. And I think that when people see two men like that going back and forth, not just because they're men, but it could have been women, but just two people that we all respect going back and forth, it's like, where do we stand? And I think a lot of people in the community were upset that it happened, because it can be really hurtful to see people doing good who don't agree. And then you see consequences. Like, you see, I guess he was talking about in the article, what had happened with Donald, and there were hearings and there were like all these ethical questions. So that whole process, I believe, was extremely hurtful to not only Donald, but the community. In my opinion, like, that's kind of what I thought we were going through.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And, you know, and can you pick sides? Do you pick sides? I think there are a lot of nuances here. There are a lot of, it's just a lot more complicated, you know? And I think, again, just speaking to just how, yeah, there's a lot of, you know, contradictory, it's very contradictory, this on all sides. Like, because Mel, I'm not like people, you know, hey, Dalton, are you right? Are you left? I have issues certainly with,
you zig and zag. Right. You're everywhere.
But that's what I do. And I have my own, you know, like, I kind of try to craft my own narrative. I'm not picking any side, to be honest, right? Because I have issues on both sides, on all sides, right? But that's, you know, I might be in the minority, right? So people, they like to do this kind of, you know, campy kind of like, hey, you know, that's not what I do, right? So it's very tough for me to, yeah.
Well, know? I think it's nice if we can decide, you know, maybe we didn't take a side. That's why this is still going on. And let's keep talking about it.
That's like, right, precisely.
I mean, I was critiquing Donald in my article with McLean's, the one he mentioned, but if I didn't know Donald, I wouldn't be able to critique him that way. Like, Donald taught me to be that critical. It was just different because it was him. So I feel like we're all in this together. Does that sound corny?
Right. Like, is this kind of, you know, like a Rodney King? Can we all just get along, you know, like after?
Yeah, read the article and let's all talk about it. Why not?
That's right. Keep the dialogue flowing, you know, and, you know, don't feel any pressure to, yeah, I think this idea of picking sides or like, I don't know if that's the answer either, you know?
I'm all over the place. I can't. I can't even pick myself. Thank you for joining us for this whole season.
Yeah, no, thank you. It was a fantastic, we had some... it's a wild ride, you know, some great conversations, great dialogue being stimulated. And we're here to provoke, right? We're here to titillate. We're here to stimulate.
I always forget that. But yes, thank you, Dalton.
No, thank you, Mel.
Thank you so much for joining us this episode. And we'd like to give a special shout out to our super producer, Kevin Sexton, our showrunner, Clara Brassard, and Ryan Clark, who's been doing our sound mixing. We really appreciate all of you.
And remember, listeners, go on the Apple Store and write reviews, rate us. This is the stuff, this is the type of feedback we need, because we know we're doing a great job, but we need to hear back from you.